Hey, it's Maurice. Before we get started with this week's episode, I just want to thank you so much for listening to and supporting Revision Path. It really means a lot. As we approach our milestone 300th episode, we want to learn more about you. Please take our audience survey at revisionpath.com/survey. It should take about 5 minutes to complete, and it will really help us out a lot for future episodes, future guests, events, and a lot more. Again, that's revisionpath.com/survey. We'll also put a link in the show notes of this episode. Thank you.
You're listening to the Revision Path Podcast, a weekly showcase of the world's Black graphic designers, web designers, and web developers. Through in-depth interviews, you'll learn about their work, their goals, and what inspires them as creative individuals. Here's your host, Maurice Cherry.
Welcome to the Revision Path Podcast. My name is Maurice Cherry, and listen, we are a little over a month away from hitting the big 300. That's 300 episodes. Now, we've been around for a little over 6 years. We just celebrated our 6th anniversary back in February. And let me tell you, hitting 300 episodes is a huge milestone in the podcasting game. I mean, there's very few shows out there that can say they have that many episodes. But I've got a question for you. Who do you think we should have as a guest in the future? Who would you like for us to interview? We've already had some pretty amazing folks on the show, and I know that there's plenty more great designers out there we can talk to. So hit us up on Twitter, that's @RevisionPath, and let us know. Now let's get into this week's interview. This week I'm talking with Abraham Asifal, co-founder of the pop-up agency based in London, England. Let's start the show. All right, so tell us who you are and what you do.
My name is Abraham Abi Asifal. I am the founder of a company called The Pop-Up Agency. It's basically a creative agency that is known for solving briefs in 48 hours. So that's what we're known for, our agile creative process. For the last 7 years, we worked in over 55 countries, worked with everything from brands to governments to agencies to NGOs, you name it. So yeah, that's me and that's us.
So I'm curious about this solving briefs in 48 hours, because first of all, when people go to the website for the pop-up agency, that's the first thing they see is they scroll down the page in huge red letters. We solve briefs in 48 hours. Now I've ran a studio too. I ran a studio for 9 years. So I have to ask, like, how do you do it in 48 hours? What's that approach like?
There's obviously, I mean, the story goes as following. So like, the way we solve it, first and foremost, the way we solve for briefs in 48 hours is that at the end of the day, what it is focus. It's focus, it's having all the stakeholders in the room, clear sort of brief, and then it's just about having this clear structure and then keeping people, getting people aligned, and voila, you solve the briefs in 48 hours. But if I take a step back and I try to explain to you like why we choose to work that way, so 7 years ago, my background actually is in law and politics, but then I studied 1 year design lead to a postmaster in Sweden at a school called Hypo Island. And 2 weeks into this program, so just to give you this understanding, that half of the class was Scandinavian students and half of them were international students. And the requirement was you needed a bachelor and some work experience to go. So everybody has some kind of experience. Really quickly, when I started this program, I realized there's a lot of smart people here. So how do I create a side project that allows me to work with as many people as possible? So basically, with that in mind, I came up with the idea of a pop-up agency. And I just picked the 5 people that at that point, 2 weeks into the program, I was sort of vibing with. And explained the idea, and then from there on, we basically sort of boiled down our needs and values and created it. And so just to give you an example, it was just like wanting to work shorter projects, wanting to work globally, wanting to constantly evolve and learn thus from those roles in my company, and so on and so on. And that's how we came about. And then if you're wondering, why the 48 hours? So the reason why it became 48 hours and not 72 hours, well, or any else, time frame, was because at that point we were students, we were very busy, and the only time we actually had to execute something was during the weekends. Thus the 48 hours. And you ask, what do you deliver after 48 hours? The deliverable was an idea, a concept. So that's the story. And that's why, you know, we saw business in 48 hours. So that first student year, you know, the objective was to sort of prototype this concept. If it's like, does this actually work? Is there a need for this? And secondly, launch it. So what we did was, first and foremost, sort of like articulated and crafted what is it, you know, so we all were clear about that. Secondly, it was about, like, cool, how do we prototype and launch this? We came up with this idea of sort of a pop-up tour, 15 weeks, 15 clients, 15 countries. That was the way we sort of were going to sort of launch it and prototype it. But before that, we had like even earlier prototyping. And then just to fast forward, so we did that first year as students, and we did 26 jobs in 16 countries.
Wow.
And then graduated and then moved to London and set it up. And the reason why we chose London, I mean, now I'm jumping ahead here, you know, it was between being in New York and in London. And for us, it was very important to be a global business. And it just made just sense to be in London because time zone, language, it just made sense to be in London. New York, which is too far away from everything else.
Mm-hmm.
Even if we had majority of our clients in the US, so we just chose to be in London. So, yeah.
Now, do you approach every project for the pop-up agency like this in that same kind of 48-hour time span?
The principle, yes. But some project requires more than 48 hours. The majority of our projects are the 48 hours. So, obviously, we've evolved from that. That's sort of how we started, and that's what put us on the map. But at the end of the day, what we also realized, so the core proposition and what we were really good at was our agile creative process. And we used that to sort of go in and help clients and solve problems. But we also used that to go in and sort of train an organization on how to become more agile and creative. But to your question, majority of our jobs are still the 40 hours. So that's what they prefer. But some require a bit longer.
Okay.
What then happened is like you have like multiple 48 hours. So it becomes multiple iterations of that beast of a project.
So what is a regular day like for you, if that even exists? I can only imagine just from looking at your website, you have this extensive travel schedule. Like this year, it's Paris, it's Davos, Stockholm, Berlin, Moscow, Nairobi, New York, D.C. What is a regular day like with all of the being in all these different cities at you know, sometime during the year?
I mean, I think it's like I have sort of two gears for me or my team. It is we're in London at our offices and conducting daily work, and that could be catching up with the admin and mail and whatnot, sort of the development in terms of sort of products and services that we're creating, and then just catching up internally with the team. But then the other side is, we're on site working on a project together with our clients. So there's like these two different sort of like, I'm either in London together with my team and working on internal things, or I'm away on site working with a client. And then going back, the reason why we travel so much is regardless if we're going in and solving a problem or we going in and sort of training an organization to become more agile and creative, we always have to be on site. That's the only way we could sort of accelerate things.
Mm-hmm.
So don't get me wrong, we live in a, you know, time where everybody's pro remote work lifestyle. And you know, kudos to that. But for us to do what we do, we see it as like, you know, digital is a great tool, but at the end of the day to really make things happen and accelerate, we need to be on site and have all the stakeholders in the room, and that's the way we sort of accelerate things.
Yeah. I have to imagine your discovery and intake process is probably pretty stringent in order to find the types of clients that will allow you to work in that way, right?
No, it is. And I think it's something that has taken time to understand and learn how to do it. Because now we include the client in the process. In the beginning, we didn't do that. We came in sort of like as a parachuted in as a sort of a SWAT team and got the sort of challenge and got a space within the company and then start working on it. And then voila. After the 48 hours, here was the solution. But we found some challenges with that. We realized, for example, you know, there's one thing is coming up with a solution, but then another thing is, especially in our case, when we work with such a large organization, mm-hmm. there's a lot of politics. So one thing is us coming up with a solution, but then there's the another journey that the idea has to go through and have a co-sign from a lot of people before actually it could see daylight. And also that, you know, our part is the sort of ideation phase. We help them come up with ideas and align people. So we are not a part of the implementation. So then it's even more important that the client have that clear ownership and understanding of the ideas. So we had to involve them in the process. And what I'm coming to now is like that took time also to understand how to sort of navigate and how to sort of facilitate that sessions, those sort of interactions, because you're coming in there as external and you're there to help them and provide solution. But then you're also at the same time trying to sort of facilitate and navigate this, the people that are in the room.
So, yeah, I would imagine that's interesting. You're coming in, you're giving these ideas, but you're not involved in the implementation. You're basically making sure the client is ready to implement what you all have already suggested.
Exactly. So that's why when we go in and do these projects, we always have all the stakeholders. So that means the ones that the decision makers, the ones that are going to build it, everybody is in that room together. So when we leave, everybody is have the ownership and that clear understanding what the idea is and how we're going to go about to sort of implement it. So like in the beginning, and this is sort of obviously, it's inevitable, evolution, change. We started as purely sort of like as a creative agency, and in the sense of like we came in there, we came up with these solutions and great ideas for our clients. But as we were, you know, running our own business, our interest and understanding for business and strategy grew. So that is also applied in the solutions today, you know. So that's why, you know, in the beginning we would walk into the creative and the marketing departments and work with them. But now we still do to some degree, but majority of our time also now we go in much more often to the board, the founder and CEO level, mm-hmm. and work with them. And that's also why, you know, in the beginning of our journey, you could see us as a purely creative agency. Today, you could look at us and it's a hybrid between a creative agency and a management consultancy.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. It kind of sounds like that hybrid.
Because at the end of the day, our skill set is more geared towards the soft skills, not the hard skills, in the sense of like, it's much more on the thinking side of things, not so much on actually physically building it.
So with the clients that you have that are all over the world, I'm curious, one, what are the best types of clients for you, I guess, in terms of the type of work they do? And two, have you found that international clients, and I'm assuming clients that are in Europe or Asia or wherever, or Africa, are they easier to work with than clients in the US?
I think, like, this is going to sound, but like, I think our ideal client is all our clients. And what I mean with that is, like, when you co-sign to the way you're going to work with us, because we're not your average agency. Oh, and don't get me wrong, I have nothing against anybody else. But what I mean is like you need to commit, not mm-hmm. just time and resources when you work with us. There's a lot of things that you have to sort of, okay, cool. In order to have this accelerated process, I need to agree to this because this is the way it's going to work. So like in the beginning, we were much more open, and we worked with a lot of type of clients. But you know, we realized that this doesn't work. Like there's a certain type of client that needs this, and they need to be of a certain mindset to actually make this work and see the value of what we do. So we have this like rigorous process of like that they need to sort of like we need to do our research, but then also they have to co-sign before entering with us. So that's a long answer for saying that, you know, the clients that we work with, we're happy with them. They are our ideal clients. And that, again, by doing that rigorous process, also that is also assuring that we have the right type of client that actually needs our value, but then also are willing to come back because they see the value and they need this. Mm-hmm. Because there are all clients out there that needs it, but they're not willing to, you know, commit to what comes with this accelerated process.
Yeah. I would imagine some clients, you know, and the reason that I asked about, and I still kind of want to know the answer to this in terms of the difference between international and like clients in the US is that sometimes clients just want you to come in and just do the work. They're throwing money at the problem and they don't really want to get involved with it. They just need it done. And it sounds like because of the process that you all have built with the pop-up agency, that's not how y'all work.
Yeah. And especially what we're trying to solve. You know, yeah. You can't do that. Like, it's so complex and big things that's going to affect the business. You need to have everybody involved. You can't just outsource that. And I understand some things, outsource that. I understand you can do it. But the types of sort of work that we do, you need to have everybody. You can't just outsource that. So you need to have them committed in the room, and we need to keep them accountable for it. And in terms of your second question, I think that's something that's so interesting. So, for example, I think my background has helped me a lot, and some of my team members also. But it's like I grew up in a very, very. I lived in 4 countries. I lived in 4 countries, and I've lived in 3 countries at the age of 7. So I've always had a diverse surrounding around me all the time. So. Mm-hmm. Didn't really realize that was sort of an asset in itself to understand how to navigate through different cultures. But that's basically what I do on a daily base with my business, because I'm constantly working with people from different cultures. And obviously, you have to take that in consideration because, it's just like it was nothing something that I thought about as I was starting the business, but it's definitely something very important that, it's just like you can't do business the same way in every nation, in every country. You can't do that. Like it's done differently, and you have to sort of respect that and work around that. So I definitely see that on a daily basis, and there's definitely differences. There's no doubt. Mm-hmm. There's no doubt. And it took me a minute to realize that, to really see it, because there's a lot of impressions to digest. But there's massive culture differences in terms of. Working, there's a difference between just being within Europe. There's differences, obviously.
Yeah.
Even if it's there's a difference being in North America, and then there's a difference between being in Africa and Asia and different parts of Asia. So yeah.
So you mentioned growing up in these different countries as a child. So I'm curious to know, was creativity a big part of your childhood?
I would say no. It was definitely not. No, it was not. I mean, my mom. And my dad, for that matter, they were very keen, like many, immigrant or uneducated parents, just like, obviously we moved to the West just for us to have a better future. But, for them, it was traditional sort of working titles as a doctor, teacher, lawyer, or engineer. Those were the sort of things they were sort of pushing us and encouraging us to do. So creativity was definitely not existing. And my, as growing up, no, that was never present at all.
Do you remember what it was like going from country to country like that as a child?
I have vague memories. So just to give an understanding. So I'm born, I have a heritage in Eritrea. That's where I'm from. I was born in Saudi Arabia, in Jeddah. And then I moved at the age of 4 to Europe. I moved to France first and foremost and was there for roughly a year. And then we continued further to Germany. I was there for 2 years and then eventually ended up in Sweden. And that's like where I spent the majority of my childhood, where I grew up. So I have like vague memory of moving around a lot. And even within Sweden, we moved, I think like 3-4 times before we settled in a small town. Mm-hmm. And that's, so there's a lot of that, like the first sort of 10 years of my life was a lot of moving around with my mom and my younger brothers. My dad stayed.
And as you told me before we started recording, there's actually a pretty big Eritrean population in Sweden.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely a big community. It's like, you have like East African, like of the African nations, East Africa has the biggest representation in Sweden, and Somalian being number one, and then I think I would say Eritreans are number two. Mm-hmm. And like, without having the facts in front of me, but I would say like Eritrean community outside of Eritrea would be, not in that order, but like US, Germany, Italy, Sweden are probably where you find most Eritreans.
What draws them there? I'm curious.
I mean, I assume it is that other Eritreans are there. I mean,
that's real talk. You want to go where other people are there.
Yeah, I mean, like the same things with Westerners, like they call it not immigrants, but they call it expats.
Mm-hmm.
I just was in Ghana now. Like I saw parts of Ghana where I just saw, you know, British and French, and, you know, and it's just, we all do that.
Yeah.
So I think, especially when we did that move from Germany to Sweden, it was word to mouth.
Mm.
Like my mom had friends and family members that was in Sweden. They were liking it and they thought it was good. Ended up there.
That makes sense. So you studied political science and law. When did you know that, I guess, going into the sort of creative agency work was what you wanted to do for a living? When did that shift happen?
I think it was when I started studying at uni, and it definitely was sort of, I was living in a very isolated area in Sweden, sort of in the sense of like, it was just immigrants, working class immigrants. When I came to uni, my whole world like was just sort of disrupted in terms of like the types of people that I was surrounded with. They were from different classes of Sweden, but then also they were international students. So that sort of opened up a whole new world for me. And what happened was, instead of like being resistant to that and like being defensive, I was embracing it. I was taking it in. Slowly I was, you know, taking that side in. But I think what the pivotal moment was, I have a younger brother who's 5 years younger than me, Madhane. Mm-hmm. He came to, I think I was around, probably I was 27. I was almost finishing up political science and my law degree. And he came to me, he's like, listen, I don't think this is for you. I don't think this is for you.
Hmm.
I think you should venture out to the creative industry. And by then, during my uni year, so like 5 years into my uni, I was doing bits of sort of things on the side. I was DJing. I created my first company. But I never saw that as a sort of like, this is going to be my 9-to-5. This is going to be my job moving forward. I never saw that. I just saw it like, okay, this is a hobby and I'm just doing things here. I'm working with music. I'm working with clients in my new company. I'm working with publishing a bit with that. I was just experimenting. I had no sort of direction. I was just doing things.
Mm-hmm.
Then my brother told me, you know, Samantha, you should rethink this. And that's when I took a break from that and studied 1 year design lead. And I just, and even when I came into that, I'll be honest, I still remember like the first week I was studying this postmaster program design lead, I was just so nervous because all of the people around me, they had experience in this field, sort of they were like, they studied creative, they worked in the creative industry. I felt a bit of a fraud when I came in there. Like the first 2 weeks, I was, let's say first 1.5 weeks.
This was Hyper Island?
Hyper Island, yeah.
Yeah.
And I was just super reserved. But then somehow I just came to this sort of like realization, I'm here for myself. I can't compare myself to these people in this room. I got to focus on my skill set, what I'm strong at, and just take what I want from here and then just get out of here. Yeah, but and then just from there on, I just unapologetically was myself and just went with it.
It sounds like Hyper Island was really sort of the nexus point for you in your career.
I think yes and no. I would say like I definitely believe like my first company that I ran, because I ran that like not considering, not seeing it to be my future. I ran that for 6 years as I was in uni. And my brother, that was what was pivotal. And then what Hyper did was sort of give me more sort of the language, the tools, and sort of that more understanding. Because, I mean, up until then, I was sort of reinventing the wheel. It's like I did not know what I was doing. I was just doing things on the fly. And I was learning. But then I was like, I went into school and just like, I learned more. And all of a sudden, I took that raw, all that, you know, I took the sort of energy that I had and then all of a sudden now I had knowledge and I could navigate much faster through the industry. And I think like, even like, I think that's been my benefit running my business. It's just like, I didn't have that much baggage. I came in very naive. I didn't know a lot of the things. That's why I just, okay, let's do it like this. Let's run the business like this. I think that helped a lot. Had I understood more the where I am today, I think I would have been much more conservative. I don't think I would have dared to come up with the idea that I did back then.
I like that idea of coming in with no baggage into a sort of design or education, sort of like a design education track. And the reason I'm saying that is because certainly there's more than one way to be a designer. There's more than one way to be a designer in this industry. You don't necessarily have to go the route of, you know, art school, undergrad, and then intern apprenticeship somewhere, and then working at some big company. And sometimes that, even though it sounds like that's the ideal track, what that ends up doing, like you said, is it gives you baggage when you go into other sorts of design things, because you're pulling from this past history of what you think it's supposed to be, or how you may have experienced it before, and it can hinder you. And it sounds like the fact that you came in without that was really a benefit.
Listen, it's mad. I studied that for 1 year. Mm-hmm. I did not even design a keynote.
Wow.
I don't even know how they, like, they gave me the, I mean, I know why they did it. Like, yeah. They gave me, I still passed, but I just realized my skill set was on the soft side, not the hard side. So like, I have soft skills, not hard skills. So I just went with it. I was like, I was not even trying to learn a bit of the hard skills. I was like, you know what? I am 28. I know what I'm good at. I'm going to focus on that. And I'm not interested in designing and coding. I'm not. So I'm like, let's focus on what I'm good at. Like, I have a strong drive. I'm very vision driven. I'm good at leading people. So it's like, I just focus on that, what I was good at.
Who or what are some of your influences?
I would say my mother, my family, my culture, 100%. Because I think, like, you know, like, up until then, up until sort of like, and this is also one of the main reasons I entered the creative industry, you know, like, I'm studying law and politics mainly for my parents' sake, you know. Mm-hmm. And with that comes, there's a sort of, you're molded into a box. You dress and talk in a certain way. What I felt like when I was entering the creative industry was, here's a place where diverse thinking, being different, is valued. I was like, yo, this is the place where I should be. Because my sort of like complex, you know, identity in terms of like being from somewhere else, but grew up here, like, I'm allowed to bring all sides in of me here. And that was like, yeah, of course, this is here. This is where I should be. I do not know how I'm going to make a living by being in this place, but this is what I should be, because I'm allowed to be myself here. And then that ties back into sort of like why I think like the greatest inspirations are still, at the end of the day, it is my family, it is my culture, that I think to a certain degree was a bit suppressed, being another culture, working in an industry that just wants you to be a robot, you know, like law, politics, like, it's just, so stepping into the creative industry was a liberating feeling, and I think that's why this is where I belong.
I'm allowed to be myself here. That's powerful. That's a powerful thing to say.
Yeah, and I think like that's still at the end of the day what I love and appreciate more. Obviously there's much more work to be done in the industry, because we might say we value diverse thinking and whatnot, but at the end of the day it doesn't reflect that. But yeah, we're working on that side of things, but that's why I'm in it, and I'm still in it, and I did that sort of pivot, and I you know, bless my brother for you know, giving me that sort of reality check and making me iterate in terms of where I should put my energy and focus.
Do you feel satisfied creatively?
Yes and no. Like, yes, in the sense of like in the space that I am, but I'm like, I'm always sort of, I that's a struggle that I have to enjoy what I'm doing right here, right now, because I'm always already like, I'm thinking on the second and third step ahead, like, okay. So even like, I even remember like the first year, there was so much thing that happened. You know, I was in 16 countries, did 26 jobs. We were having coverage all over the place, you know, in terms of our company. Mm-hmm. But I was like, looking back at it, I was not present. There's so much things going on. I mean, and that's something I'm trying to work on with myself, like try to be more present and enjoy what's going on, but also at the same time, still look forward.
Yeah. I know that feeling all too well, because sometimes I think with creative types, we're so focused on the future. It's just, by the time other people have caught up to what we've already done, we're over it. like it's in the past, you know, it can, and it can be sometimes a struggle to try to relish it, I think, as it happens. You know what I mean? So I get what you mean about that struggle is enjoying it. Like being present in the moment is tough because you're so focused on like, what's the next thing? What's the next thing? I mean, I can give, you know, just Revision Path as an example. Like we're doing the show, we're recording and everything. I'm already thinking, you know, our 300th episode is coming up. Our 325th episode, I think, is going to be like later on in the year. Like I'm thinking, what do we do to get to year 7? Cause now this is year 6. Like what do we do to get to year 7 and to level up and to keep the conversation going? Because in terms of design podcasts, like we're one of the longest running ones. There's like Design Matters, there's Adventures in Design, there's us. and the fact that we're so focused on a particular niche of, and even to call it a niche, I feel like is doing it a disservice, but we're focused on talking to Black designers and creatives. This is something that hasn't been done for this long, continually at a part, I'd say at a point where people are really visibly seeing it. So I'm always thinking like, what's the next thing I have to do? I'm never really thinking about right now. Like last year we got a bunch of awards and stuff like that and it was great, but I'm thinking like, what are we doing when we get to 300, you know, which would happen the next year. So I'm already like, I get what you're saying is what I'm trying to say.
But you know, that said, listen, kudos, respect for the work that you've done. It's like, that's really impressive. 300 episodes. That's hats off.
Thank you. What kind of dream project do you have that you want to do one day?
I don't know if I should put it out there, but
well, you can put out as much as you're comfortable with.
Like I'm always big picture, so I have this idea of like being involved on a sort of nation level to sort of. How do we sort of stimulate? In some cases, about stimulating creative economies, and in some cases, about kickstarting creative economies. So that for me is more geared to working that towards the continent, going back to Africa and working. That's why I try to be there more and more often for the last couple of years to try to sort of figure out, like, understand how do I add value and how can I contribute and plant seeds here. That's a dream project that would have, like, just like how I could do something on that level. Don't get me wrong, I mean, I'm come back, see me in 5 years, I'll have probably a couple of more companies under my belt, and I'll keep, you know, building businesses, focus on change and purpose driven business always. But I have this dream idea of like, how could I be involved on a national level? That's also why, you know, like you mentioned Davos, in our sort of schedule. And for the ones who don't know Davos, Davos is on schedule, for this year is that we were at the World Economic Forum, and that's the second time we've been. Wow. And again, it is like you won't probably see that many creative agencies at the Davos. And again, this is, I think it connects to sort of like, you know, we're known for our agile process, but also our message that, you know, that we believe that everyone is creative and we want to sort of use creativity as sort of vehicle for change and human progress. So that's again, the thing is at the end of the day, the business is a reflection of us as founders, but, you know, I also realize sometimes I cram in a lot of me and my founder, sort of all of values in our business. But at the same time, I also realize maybe I need to do that, some things outside of my business. So that is, especially in this, when I'm talking about this dream project of sort of working on a national level and then maybe on a continent level, sort of how do you develop and stimulate creative economy? And in some cases, it's about kickstarting it.
Yeah, you mentioned, you know, the continent, and you were just recently in Ghana, in Accra. What was that experience like?
That was amazing. So to all Ghanaians, thank you so much for your hospitality. So, as I said, I'm from East Africa. I've never been in West. And one experience it was Ghana. Oh, all the Ghanaians, listen, I can't explain how much I loved you before. But I love you even more now after being in your country. It's just, the way I was taken care of and the experience that I had, it was beautiful. I really enjoyed it. I was also really surprised to see the amount of people moving from Europe, the US, back to Ghana. I see that also in Nigeria a lot. Mm-hmm. Like in West Africa, people are moving back a lot. I mean, whether they have roots in these countries or not, I see a lot of people, predominantly black people, coming back. People of color moving back to the continent and doing great things. Mm-hmm. But then also, I was fortunate enough to meet amazing, talented people in the continent that was doing great things. I mean, in Ghana. So no, it was an amazing experience. I was there to for a project with a local business, really progressive. You know, it's a business that sort of is a family owned business, been around for like, I think 12 or 13 years. So within that big company, they have sort of three verticals, so just or three companies. One that focuses on security, one that focuses on green energy, and one focused on logistics. It was really inspiring to be there. Yeah.
I have heard so many good things about Ghana, about Accra specifically, but about Ghana. I have heard so many good things from people visiting. I know people that have moved there. Like there's this you've heard of the Brexit. There's this thing called the Blaxit.
Oh, I'm well aware of that.
Of people like, specifically of like African Americans moving to Africa. And this one person I know who moved there, told me that the reason that she moved is that she went to visit. She had come back and visited about 3 or 4 times. And she said that when she was there, it didn't feel like she had to prove herself to like anyone else's standards there. Like in America, it can certainly, especially if you live in a big city, it can be that way where so much of what we do is inevitably rooted in some level of competition, because that's how like American exceptionalism just sort of thrives, thanks to capitalism. But over there, it's like, they say it just feels like a totally different, it's a totally different vibe. I want to go. I got to go. I'm putting that out there in the universe. I want
to
go.
Yeah. Yeah. Do, please do. And listen, I've been to 5 different countries in the continent, and they're all beautiful and amazing in their own ways. But do you have a point there in terms of sort of like, Ghana was interesting in the sense of like, yeah, it's very, I mean, all of the African nations are very welcoming, but like it's on another level.
Mm-hmm.
So I could see why there's a lot of people that are from Ghana that are moving back, but then there are also people that are not Ghanaians that are moving there. They're just like, I enjoy being here. I feel very welcomed. And so, yeah, I could definitely see that. It's a beautiful place.
Yeah. So with all the travels that you've done, you know, for work throughout the world, I feel like you have this very unique perspective on where design and creativity is going in the future. Can you talk about that a little bit? Like where you see it going?
Dude, that's a tough one. Like I'm not a big one on trying to predict things, but what I see though is like, I mean, I don't know. I just see design used in different ways. And I mean, I myself am a great example of that. Like I'm using the principles of design, but as a sort of, as an entrepreneur, as a business owner, with my soft skills and not as with hard skills. And I'm seeing it also being used. I mean, there's no secret that the role of design has significantly increase in terms of like its importance and its need, you know, the last, you know, decade, if not more. But I'm just seeing it also be more and more and more used for purposely, in different ways, if that says anything. But yeah, that's my 2 cents on that.
What advice would you give to someone who wants to follow in your footsteps with what you've done?
I say this a lot, but I'll say this again. I would say, be naive enough to believe in yourself and your ideas. Be stubborn enough to see them through, but then also be smart enough to have a support system around you with people that have more experience than you, that could guide you and advise you. Those are the 3 things I would say are the key things. And this is something I live by myself. So to emphasize, really, like the things that I just said now is very basic, but like they could have a significant impact on your life. I can't stress that. And especially the last part and of having smart and more experienced people around you that could guide you and advise you. I waited a bit long. I waited almost 2.5 to 3 years into my journey with my business. But when I did it, it significantly changed things. I was learning things on a much faster pace, and I was applying it. And, you know, it impacted our bottom line and everything. Like, it was a crucial. But, like, what I would say, though, to that is also, like, first and foremost, you need to figure out what are the areas of sort of, you know, skill set or domain that you're sort of missing in terms of knowledge and skill set within your business. Mm-hmm. And then based on that, you find profiles that fit that. But these profiles, don't get it twisted, they have to be the Serena Williams of their domain. You're not looking for a middle management. And like, I did that mistake first. I took people that had interesting titles and worked for interesting brands, but I realized that this is not the type of people I need. First and foremost, some of these people haven't even, they don't own their businesses. So do your due diligence. What are the areas that you need help with? Find those profiles and make sure that they are the Serena Williams of their domain.
Where do you see yourself in the next like 5 years or so? What kind of work would you like to be doing?
I think what I know at this stage, there's three things I know. I think I'm going to be, so up until now, so I've run this business, the Power of Agents, for 7 years, and I've had a previous business for 6 years. So I've been independent for 11 years now. Oh, sorry, for 13 years. But all of that has been service focused, consulting, agency, and whatnot. So I would want to go into more product side and be a product owner and see that journey. I know that I'm going to be more in the continent. I'm pretty confident about that. And I know I'm going to have at least one, if not two more businesses in the near future.
Well, just to kind of, you know, wrap things up here, where can our audience find out more about you and about your work online?
Our website, thepuffagency.co. And if not there, you can find me and my company on Twitter, Instagram. That's where I'm most active.
All right. Sounds good. Well, Abraham Asifo, I want to thank you so much for coming on the show and for sharing. I mean, one, for sharing about your business, because I feel like what you all are doing is so unique in the kind of creative space right now in terms of traveling and doing these things. It's like a kind of creative consultancy. I feel like that is something that is really, I don't want to say it's the future, but certainly I think we're moving towards that, especially if we're looking at diversity in the industry and stuff, but also sharing just your background and how your life has gotten to this point in terms of moving from different countries and, you know, starting, you know, maybe even a little bit later in life to going into the creative field. I really feel like this is an interview that people are going to walk away from and get a lot of information. I think you dropped a lot of gems here. So thank you so much for coming on the show. I appreciate it.
Bless you. And thank you so much for having me. It's been an honor and a real pleasure. Thoughts of love are
in your mind. And that's it for this week. Big thanks to Abraham Asifo, and thanks to you for listening. You can find out more about Abraham and his work through the links in the show notes at glitch.com/revisionpath. Revision Path is a Glitch Media Network podcast and is produced by Deanna Testa and edited by Keisha TK Dutez. Our intro voiceover is by Music Man Dre, with intro and outro music by Yellow Speaker. We're also powered by Simplecast, the easiest way for podcasters to publish and distribute audio on the internet. Make sure you check the show notes for a link to sign up for a 14-day free trial. If you liked this episode, then let more people know about it by leaving us a rating and a review on Apple Podcasts. It takes about a minute or so to do, and it really helps spread the word about Revision Path everywhere. You can also find us on Spotify, we're on Google Podcasts, we're on SoundCloud, pretty much anywhere you can find your favorite shows. And make sure you're following us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter as well. Just search for Revision Path. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll see you next time.